From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. There's new music from Slater Kinney, and that hasn't happened in almost 10 years. The trio of Corin Tucker, Carrie Brownstein, and Janet Weiss are releasing a new record called No Cities to Love on January 20th. We have a taste of some of that music here today. We wondered what brought Slater Kinney back together again and how they went about recording new music after so long. So the band gathered in a studio in Portland. Robin Hilton and I are here in Washington, D.C. And we started with the obvious question. Who called who?
That's the big question. So I'm glad you asked it because people do want to know that.
That's right.
So who made that call?
Well, this is Corin. And actually, Carrie was at my house. We were hanging out, and I think we were watching Portlandia episodes that they were working on. And Fred was there, too.
Is this product placement?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Season 5, January 8th.
And I don't know. We were talking about playing music, and I think we were talking about playing a show or something. And I said, well, I wonder, you know, if we're ever going to do a Slater Kinney show again.
Did you turn off Portlandia and talk about it?
Yep, we did. Well, this is Carrie. I think we had two people in the room who are known fans of the band. One is Corin's husband, Lance Bangs, and the other is Fred Armisen, who was a fan of the band long before he and I worked together. And they were very encouraging and I think just kind of wouldn't let that conversation die. Like, they really wanted to figure out a way logistically that we could make this happen, up to the point of even discussing like a time frame and, you know, strategizing whether it would be couched as more of a one-off show or going back and playing the old songs and kind of a...
Just for the two of them.
Yes, just for them at Corin's house. So it was something that began percolating then, and we talked to Janet and, you know, just... The conversation started, and that was a couple of years ago, actually. That was probably 2.5, 3 years ago.
Was there something that in the beginning when you started talking about it that you knew immediately if you were going to do it, it would have to be this, or it would have to, you wouldn't want to do something else? I mean, did you know right away, immediately going into it, well, if we're going to do it, it has to be done a certain way?
I think pretty quickly we kind of went through some different options, and we're like, one-off show? No, it's just, that's just not good enough. Or a handful of shows, like that also just, it wasn't satisfying enough until we really kind of talked it through and was like, we really want to try and do a reinvention if we can.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when we stopped the band, it felt more like putting something on pause. We had a lot of momentum. We certainly hadn't slowed down in any way or put out an album that we felt tepid about or that the audience felt tepid about. So it wasn't like we were going to have to revive a corpse. You know, it felt like just...
Clear!
Yeah. It didn't feel like anything other than a challenge in the same way that we would have been challenged if we had tried to make a record in the years following The Woods. You know, that challenge still very much existed of how to make a record that didn't sound like the others. And I think we knew right away we didn't want it to be nostalgia-based, which is something that I feel very allergic to.
So it was always going to be start with new material. Once you start going through the cards of what this thing could be and it was going to be bigger than a one-off, it had to be new material.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, we started writing once we kind of figured that out. We started writing kind of privately to see if we could come up with something that would get us all excited enough to keep doing it.
So where'd you do that and how? Somebody with an acoustic guitar or a...
Yeah, it was pretty much acoustic.
Yeah.
Just a dobro and a... no, we were in actually a variety of locations. Corin and I played a little bit in her living room. The three of us played in Corin's basement. I was living in Austin for a while and flew Corin out. We wrote there. We wrote in my basement. I mean, it took on many permutations, and eventually we settled on a process that was a little more akin to what we had done in the early years, which was, and I think it was partially because Corin and I had to kind of reacquaint ourselves with the very specific vernacular that she and I speak musically. And so her and I would work on songs and then bring them to Janet instead of jamming, which we had really started to do a lot, culminating in the woods.
The vernacular of you two working together a little more, like you must have missed each other. You get back together and you draw things out of one another that you wouldn't get from anybody else you might have spent time with in the last 10 years. Like, those could be very creative, but what you do is different. You call it a vernacular. Describe some of it.
It's almost telepathic. I think that Korn and I can complete each other's musical sentences in a way that never ceases to surprise me. There's a eerie familiarity to what she will bring to one of my songs and vice versa. But also, it's so wrong sometimes. It's the instinct sometimes is so opposite of what I feel like anyone else would do. And in that, sometimes sourness or misfire are the moments that make this band unique, because there's so much negative space in our songs and in our guitar playing that is complimented by the other person. I mean, it's like a language that only a few people speak. And so I think, a very bizarre situation sometimes. It can also be, but I don't want to just describe it like it's magic, because it's also a lot of deliberation and editing. And we can fall into that way of speaking with each other so naturally that the challenge is to make it different. You know, we can play something so quickly that, oh, that sounds like Slater Kinney. Wow, that could have been on one beat, or that could have been on Dig Me Out. And then there's a slightly dissatisfying quality to that, even though you can kind of bask in the familiarity of that for a moment. You have to discard that and then say, well, what's next? How can we play together differently? But it's a seamless process, and it's a very frustrating one because of the ease that you can kind of just find comfort in. That's not a way that we have ever liked to make music.
You mentioned Dig Me Out. I want to play a cut from that, just a little bit from that record that I think speaks to this entire creative process. I mean, words and guitar, this song is such a mission statement in a way for the band, and I'm wondering if that mission statement has changed at all in the 20 years you've been together and the 10-year break that you've had.
I don't really think so. I mean, I think that, you know, that song to me is about just asserting ourselves as a band and kind of embracing everything that we can do as a band, and it's spiky and it's weird and it's kind of uncomfortable and it's catchy at the same time, and I think there's an element of that in the new record as well.
Pick me a song that might illustrate how you pushed one another, how you've done something that you've never done before.
Well, a song like Barrier Friends is one that I kept fighting for because I had this riff that I really wanted to make into a song. We were frustrated because we were at the end of the songwriting process. There was a lot of stress about going into the studio wanting to feel ready. This was one of the first times we were going into the studio without playing any of the songs live. And so there was...
That is really different.
Yeah. So there's a sense of vulnerability. And when you introduce a song at the last minute or kind of keep pushing everyone to work on it over and over again, it just seems like, how is this going to augment the record? How is this going to improve it? It's just going to be the one that doesn't feel done. And so there were a lot of iterations of the song and really thinking about how we wanted the different parts to feel, how we wanted the ending, how we wanted the drums. And it was a conversation that continued through the recording process with a lot of changes made during the we recorded in a few different cities, and that's pretty rare for us. I don't think we've ever done this with a song where we would go back and replace entire parts because it just, the song didn't have the right feel.
Let's hear it.
Throw away.
I love the way the drums work. I was wondering how these songs, were introduced to Janet, how they came alive. Was it at the studio? Did you work beforehand?
Oh yeah, we worked as the songs were sort of taking shape with the guitars. They would bring the parts. A lot of times we work on things as parts, maybe two parts, and then we need to figure out another part and to make it sort of become a song. There were a lot of parts and a lot of really great parts. It was part of why it took so long is that we had a lot of parts, but we didn't have like actual finished songs. And finishing the songs was challenging. But this song it needed to feel a certain way. I think I knew how I wanted it to feel, but I was having trouble getting it there. And things were changing a lot. Vocals were changing. Guitars were changing. So that we recorded a version on our first time in the studio when we did the basic tracks. And then we had a few days to work on overdubs. And Carrie actually had an idea about trying the intro to the song in halftime.
Can we just hear the intro real quick, just so we know what we're talking about here?
Yeah.
And describe what halftime means to somebody who, other than football, might not know what it means.
Can I even describe it?
Fine, you can do it.
Halftime, I mean, without using like, 16th notes and quarter notes.
I mean, okay, just go, like tell people what it would be like if it wasn't halftime, maybe.
So like if you counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, that's not halftime.
Right, clap.
Halftime
on.
Would be 1, 2, 3, 4.
There you go.
There's more space.
Yeah, you totally.
You're accenting not the 1, 2, 3, 4, but the 1 and the 2 mostly. So it's a heavier way of playing when there's a riff. It can make it sound super tough. And so it was a really great idea. And when we went back in, I overdubbed, you know, some of this song, the bridge I overdubbed in the intro, and it felt great to work that way and be able to try something later on in the process. Because usually with the drums, you're sort of just done and, you know, you've packed up and you're waiting for everything to be finished. But in this case, I got to go back in, and I think that, you know, the halftime and the, you know, the things we decided to add later really added to the song and made it move correctly, you know, make it, you know, an anthemic sort of powerful song.
You want to talk about the words some? I don't have them in front of me, so maybe you can.
Corn's looking at me a bit. You want me to talk? Yes, nodding. There was a lot of this song just feeling, there was a, the line, you know, only I get to be sickened by me, or only I get to be punished by me. A lot of this song was kind of like trying to posit yourself, your body, your mind into like a space that is like assured and safe, and sort of rejecting criticism and kind of having to figure out how to make sense of potential insignificance or irrelevance. And it's just a lot about reclamation, I think.
A song that you think you could have written 15 years ago or 20 years ago when the band was starting out, or really one that could only happen now?
Both, I think. I mean, I think lyrically, I feel like sometimes I've been writing the same song for since I wrote the song You Annoy Me when I was 16. you know, but I do think, I think more in the second verse, there's where it says, I'm singing about, you know, seeking out fragments of stillness and trying to make sense of power and struggle, not just as this propulsive, you know, like this propulsion where you're pushing against something, which is less combative and more about kind of a solidity, like an inner kind of wholeness that I think potentially I would not have sang about when I was 19.
I mean, a lot of the drive in the music can be, and especially in the early days, comes off almost not almost, comes off as aggression, comes out as frustration. So much of rock music has to do with this pent-up whatever, this pent-up energy, this pent-up emotion, this, like, pissed at the world, pissed at the way people treat you, all that stuff. And that happens when you're younger, and that comes out in the force of guitars and drums. The force in guitars and the drums are the same today in so many ways. It's maybe a little more angular, maybe much better played. But what is the driving force? You know, what is the messages in the song, and how does the message connect to the energy of the song?
And I guess for me, as someone who is interpreting the lyrics and trying to deliver a certain feel in the music, and one that reflects my personality and reflects my interpretation of their personalities, sort of combining it all, the energy, I don't really feel more comfortable when I'm playing. I feel like with the three of us, the way we connect, there's a desperation to reach a certain level, like a desperation to break through of the mundane, of the, the generic, that, you know, we're trying to push through so desperately to something bigger, that it just sort of comes out in this really powerful, forward-moving way. Mm-hmm. I don't think that has changed. I think the three of us in a room, you know, we don't write a lot of slow songs. the three of us in a room, there's a lot of sort of unbridled energy. Part of the working in this format is trying to, like, harness the energy at times. But I guess as far as young versus old, I don't really feel like I've said it all and I'm comfortable and I'm sort of ready to kick my feet up. I feel like there's a lot left to do, a lot of work to do. And if we're gonna do this, the three of us, let's make it, you know, off the charts.
Yeah, and I hear that in the playing on this record. What about the politics of what you sing about? Has that changed in the years? I mean, are the issues that you may have dealt with in politically when you started different than what you deal with now? And are things that were bad then better now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that things have changed in the past 20 years. And, you know, socially, certainly things have changed, and people have gotten more open-minded. But I think there is still some frustration, you know, in terms of seeing true equality for women in the workplace. I mean, I think that's something that, you know, we're still working towards, you know. And if anything, I felt like the opportunity to do this band again, I was so grateful for it. And that, if anything, the lyrics were almost more available to me, and the feelings of the kind of solidarity that the three of us have were even more meaningful to me. And so writing some of the lyrics to a song like Surface Envy, you know, was about that moment in terms of the excitement of being able to do Sleater-Kinney again, reach out to people again, and to do it, you know, the three of us working together again. I wanted to try and change things as much as we could in the, you know, the few moments that we might have in the spotlight.
Let's play a little bit of Surface Envy. I love the chorus on this track, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about it. So let's just listen to a little bit, and we'll talk about it when we come out. I love that line, only together do we break the rules or make the rules. And I'm wondering, you know what it means to break the rules to you now?
Well, I think, you know, part of this whole Sleater-Kinney 2.0 is breaking the rules in a bit, you know, because we, you know, we took all of our records and put them together and said, this is our work. It's really important to us. Here's, you know, a box set of everything we've done. We've remastered all of our records. And
this is Start Together that came out in October ahead of the new record.
Yeah. And just saying, like, you know, there's no one else that's going to hand us our work and say, like, this is, you know, so great what you've done. It was us. And we, you know, we wanted to tell our story and make sure that people had access to it and that, you know, it's connected into us being a band again. And, you know, that we think it's really important and that obviously we feel like we need to stand up for ourselves.
What did it feel like to go back and listen to that stuff and remaster? I assume you don't drive around with it every day. Or do
no.
you? No, just kidding. So I just was wondering what it was like to go, come back to that stuff. And I'm sure there was a good deal of pride hearing that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of different stuff on there that I was like, oh, my God, you know. Listening to the first record is definitely a trip.
Oh, my God, like, embarrassed? Oh, my God, what?
Well, yeah, there's definitely a couple of grimaces on the first record. Okay. Like, what? You know. But also just a feeling of compassion for the journey that we took, that we started the band so young. And, you know, we're just everything that we wrote about, all the different parts of our lives and all the different characters that we drew, I think they're really kind of special. And they obviously touched people really deeply. So being able to kind of take care of those records was really important, and just wanting to remaster them and you know, make sure they were still going to be available to people and could sound as good as possible. That was very satisfying.
I'd love to play something from one of those records, All Hands on the Bad One. It's a song that I think kind of ties a lot of all the things that we've been talking about together, the cuts number one must have. We talked a little bit about how some of your ideas have changed and the politics have changed over the last 20 years. You wrote so much about how hard it was to be a woman, making this kind of music in particular, being in such a male-dominated field and at the clubs. And I'm wondering if you feel like much has changed since then, if it's gotten any better.
I think that it has gotten better. You know, I just think that our society has become more progressive in talking about women's issues and safety. And, you know, I think Obama just really stepped up recently and spoke about talking to survivors of sexual assault and saying, we've got your back. We need to do something about this. You know, like, that's a really big deal. That's something no president has ever done. And, you know, someone that's in charge of our country to say, like, this is important and we need to work on this and keep working together on it. I think that's a huge step forward.
I think this year, I think of the best rock records of this year are from women. I think of like the St. Vincent record or the Angel Olsen record. I feel like it's, you know, an area that they own in many ways this year.
And even in the backline part of the music business, the sound engineers who at clubs and all those people, it's a much decent, much better mix of folks. But you'll figure that out when you get on the road and see if that's really true everywhere.
I still think if you looked at the headliners of festivals, though, the people that play after dark, I like to say it's hard to be a woman and be on the stage after it gets dark. You will see it's very male dominated, mm-hmm. still. Yeah. I mean, there's just still not a lot of women in those top slots, even though they have, you know, earned it completely. You know, it's not like things are really that different, even though some, you know, of the best work is being made by women.
What are you all listening to these days?
Go ahead.
I was curious what you're all listening to these days.
I really like that Run the Jewels record and the Perfume Genius record.
Oh.
And yeah. I did love this St. Vincent and Angel Olsen records too a lot. I wrote about both those. I feel like those are like the four things I listened to the most this year, those four things I mentioned. And I liked the War on Drugs record too.
I liked that New Pornographers record a lot. I like this band Luluk on Sub Pop.
Yeah, I madly
so
love that.
So good.
It might be my favorite album this year, Luluk. Yeah. One of the reasons I asked that question is in some ways, the music that you play doesn't feel terribly influenced by the gap, the music that happened in the gap between when you stopped and started. It's not to say that you haven't advanced as a band, but the palette, for the most part, you know, there's not electronic in the record, right?
It's not disco beats.
There's not boom, 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 you know?
No drum machine.
So the style of singing is not different than you might have sung songs, although they're sung better, not different than the style of singing you might have sung 20 years ago. And I'm just wondering if current music does anything influence you, creep into the music you make at all? Do you think that there's just this chemistry the three of you make when you get together and you can't deny it and that's what it is?
Well, I really think Sleater-Kinney is a singular band with no clear predecessor or successor. So I don't think we started out creating music that you could see the palette of colors that we were using and maybe draw a lineage, but certainly there wasn't a distinct band that we were pulling from. And I think subsequently there haven't been bands that sound like us. So I don't really know how we would have come back together and done anything other than be ourselves. I do think that I like pop music, and I think a lot about melody, but that doesn't even mean like top 40 music necessarily. It's just in the years of listening to music and what I've decided to discard and literally throw out, it tends to be music that just doesn't have good songwriting or good melody. Like, that's just what I come back to over and over again, you know, a great chorus or a great hook. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be saccharine. It doesn't have to be cheap, but it has to. I think that to me has a forcefulness to it. And I do think that this record focuses on choruses in a way that some of our earlier records didn't, although I can hear it come in on an album like All Hands on the Bad One. I can hear the poppier elements start to creep in on that record. So it's not unprecedented. But yeah, I mean, I think it's influential, but there's just such a singular aspect to this band that I think it's hard to just, you know, we're not porous. We're not really just letting a lot of outside things in. And when we do, the way that it's interpreted within the three of us, you know, what comes out doesn't sound anything like, you know, what we brought in.
I used to think that music of this sort was music with guitar, bass, and drums, I mean, was music of...
Or no bass in this case.
Yeah, right, right. Was music of youth, and that by the time you hit 30, there's no way you could make that music again. And obviously, we've all come to see lots of people make music with fierce energy that feels vital. And what I think I've come to realize is the reason that happens is the chemistry that happens between people. It's not really about the entity of what is rock and roll and what does it mean. It's just what happens when certain people get together. It's undeniable, and that's what it feels like is happening with you all. There wasn't a question.
I just wanted to comment about the idea of sort of taking on the fads or sort of the, you know, the way people are making music at a certain time. In a way, I feel like it's the danger of embracing the sort of sound of the day is that you might be forfeiting your timelessness. I think the music that I love that resonates for years and years and decades is sort of made in a bubble, in a way, in a scene or in a community, or a lot of music being made at the same studio with the same musicians. I just saw that Muscle Shoals documentary, and it's amazing to think of the music these, you know, just these guys from a tiny, tiny town made together, how they communicated to the world. They weren't really taking in a lot except their surroundings, and ended up with this amazing feel and vibe. But, you know, to think, you know, like how to approach a new record, and there are choices we could have made that would have made it sound more like maybe some other records that came out this year, last year, or 2 years ago. But for us to lock ourselves away and see what comes out is sort of kind of more interesting than to sort of look around us for the answers to our musical questions.
You want to go out on something, Mr. Hilton?
Yeah, I thought maybe we'd play just a little bit of the title cut to the album, No Cities to Love. And let's just hear a little bit of it. We can come back and talk and a little bit about it and say goodbye.
There are no cities, no cities to love. There are no cities, no cities to love.
Came up with the title, or was the title the beginning of how this song came together?
Yes. I came up with that melody. I'm sitting on my coffee table and playing guitar. We had the first part of that song, the verses. We kept discarding it. It really needed a chorus. And the melody and the lyrics came at the same time. Just, there are no cities, no cities to love. It was pretty instantaneous. And then I wrote the lyrics to the verse around that.
When I listen to this song and I think about the title, No Cities to Love, and I read some of the other names of songs on this record, just on the surface, you know, like Surface Envy, No Cities to Love, Fangless, Bury Our Friends. I don't know, there's something about this that feels... I don't know, like you're not jaded isn't the right word, but maybe just very restless still. Like you aren't at all happy with the way things are now after 20 years of making music and you know, thinking about your place in the world and the way things are. I guess the question is, how are you feeling right now? And what you know, what did you pour?
And do you want to lay down and talk about it?
We want you to just close your eyes.
Imagine.
And we're going to think of a safe place. I don't know. What do you think? Am I off on that, to think that there's that sort of vibe to this record?
I think in all of the creative pursuits I have, I feel like it's an exploration of otherness and feeling like an outsider and creating work that's strange and unusual that goes along the periphery for people to find if they need it. I think that's how I go through life, you know, kind of in an outside lane, sort of observing what's happening in the center. And so I think a lot of these songs have to do with an inchoate, almost shapelessness. And I think that's why a lot of the titles have, like Robin said, you know, words like surface and cities and these things that are logistically, technically concrete, but actually are a lot so much more murky than in reality. And just, you know, trying to make sense of what that stability is and, you know, what it means to feel other when there's so much in the middle that kind of keeps you not even just on the outside, but kind of wanting to be on the outside. So,
because
yeah.
Face it, it all annoys you. No, just kidding.
It really annoys me, Bob. Of course, Robin asked that question. He's probably going to be in a fetal position. I mean,
I've been rocking back and forth in the corner through this entire interview.
I know. I'm surprised you left the house today.
Well, thanks for doing this. I can't wait to see you play live. The last time you played, well, let's see, there was a fire emergency and they shut the club down one night. I think you came back a handful of nights. 9:30 Club, I'm thinking, if you all remember that date. And then you're coming back to the 9:30 Club?
Two sold-out nights.
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll make sure we...
You better figure this stuff out. Carrie, you said after the last, between the last record and then when you started doing Wild Flagle, your calluses had worn off your fingers. Did you have to build them back up for this record, too?
Yes, I did.
And can you still jump?
Thanks for asking.
Can you still
no problem.
Jump?
I'm just. I care.
Can you still jump as high as you used to?
No, I'm going to use a trampoline. So,
looking forward to both. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Corin Tucker, Carrie Brownstein, and Janet Weiss. The new record, "No Cities to Love," comes out January 20th from Slater Kinney. I'm Bob Boylan, along with Robin Hilton for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.